The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
At 11 a.m. on Wednesday, June 10, 1959, Virgil Stanley found the bodies of his parents in their North Fort Worth home. Both 67-year-old Vernon Stanley and 65-year-old Hattie Stanley had been savagely beaten to death, their home ransacked. Fort Worth Police Detective A.C. Howerton called the crime one of the most vicious he'd ever seen. The cops knew right away this would be a tough case to crack. At first, the obvious suspect was Vernon and Hattie's son, Virgil, who of course found the bodies, and who would also benefit from a decent inheritance and insurance payout. But they ruled him out relatively quickly. Police found a few other suspects in the month following the double murder, but nothing was sticking. On Tuesday, July 14th, however, they were sure they'd found their guy when 51-year-old Liebert Everett Swaim was caught prowling around a home in Fort Worth's Riverside neighborhood on Bird Street, a little less than a mile from the home of Hattie and Vernon Stanley. Liebert Swaim had the tools of an experienced burglar and perhaps predator, socks over his dress shoes among them, something that would not only quiet his steps after breaking into a home, but also disguise his footprints outside. After searching Swaim's home, the cops felt like they had all the evidence they needed to begin building a case against him. What followed was nothing short of a fiasco. Most of the evidence the Fort Worth police recovered from Swaim's home wasn't viable evidence, and they began a series of other measures to keep the man in county jail. We're not going to go over the entirety of what happened here, but after our series on the trio wraps up, we'll release an entire episode on Vernon and Hattie Stanley's still unsolved slayings. I'll get to the point of why we brought up the case. Liebert Everett Swaim did some bad things, some really bad things. The last thing we're doing here is sticking up for the guy or trying to paint him as a decent human being. But in the case of the murders of the Stanleys, well, it appears the cops were trying to railroad him. Since they were having trouble trying to stick Swaim with the murder charges, they charged him with narcotics possession, a bogus charge, and stuck him with a ton of state hospital stays. In the meantime, the judge at Swaim's hearing set a pretty high bond for the narcotics charges, and the man fought it. It was a struggle. At the end of the day, and after over a month in jail, these charges all failed to stick, and Liebert Swaim was released. Perhaps Liebert Swaim's trouble with this case, the cops and the courts seemingly bending justice to fit a theory in which they had no evidence, was part of the reason his son, John Winter Swaim, chose the route in life that he did.
John Swaim, I liked him. I think if he hadn't have died, he would have found out something. Because I was told that John Swaim had something on everybody downtown, almost everybody right down to the street sweeper. But I believe John Swaim would have found out something.
Before John Swaim co-founded the agency Special Services and became a thorn in the side of law enforcement and other city officials, he was already shaking things up as a bail bondsman. In 1970, Tarrant County Sheriff Lon Evans dropped him from the list of approved bondsmen in the county, but unfortunately never publicly cited a reason. Swaim's transparent dislike for law enforcement and the good old boys system undoubtedly played a role. If John Swaim wasn't already, I'd guess this is around the time he started keeping dirt on high-profile public figures to use when it served his purposes, but I can't say for sure. Eventually, things with Evans got settled, at least legally, but it took months. It's likely that John Swaim missed out on a substantial bit of money during that period, so all Sheriff Evans ended up doing, really, was adding fuel to the fire that was Swaim's disdain for the cops. John Swaim continued to be active in the Bail Bondsman Association, often setting aside the competitive nature of the business to help out other bondsmen with legal matters. Bail bonds were Swaim's bread and butter, but the man's passion was in private investigations. Essentially, John Winter Swaim was an archetype of a private dick you'd read about in a dime store detective novel. He was abrasive, drank heavily, dressed sharp, and could talk his way in or out of anything. Swaim was a controversial and polarizing figure. You loved him or hated him. Well, mostly you hated him. But the man had a reputation for getting the job done, no matter what, and without taking any shit from anybody, law enforcement included. The beginning of 1975 started off with plenty of leads in the disappearances of Julie Mosley, Renee Wilson, and Rachel Trelisa, but none were good, or at least it seemed that way. Things started to die down some, however the families themselves were still doing all they could think to do. Calls, of course, were still coming in, but instead of tips and concerns from locals, they largely consisted of psychics and seers from just about everywhere around the country. Judy Wilson forever lost articles of Renee's clothing to a few of them, and one psychic called Mrs. Wilson in February of 1975, telling her that the trio's bodies were buried in a shallow grave near a Mansfield, Texas creek. She and Rachel's sister, Deborah Arnold, walked for miles along a creek bed there, but found nothing besides a pig skull, which Deborah pulled from the water. Since the cops weren't having any luck either, and were largely seen as not taking the case seriously by families, it was time for outside help. On March 20th of 1975, when the families of the Fort Worth missing trio asked Private Detective John Swaim to find out what happened to them, he agreed to take the case for a flat fee of $500, and the reward should he find the girls. John Swaim wasted not a minute getting started. Days after he was hired, a classified showed up in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram offering a reward for information leading to the girls' whereabouts. The reward Swaim was offering was $4,000, more than the reward he stood to make should he find 17-year-old Rachel Trelisa, 14-year-old Renee Wilson, and 9-year-old Julie Mosley, as per his agreement with the families. In the classified ad, he made it a point that his company, Special Services, was not a police agency, and that contact would be held under the strictest of confidence. In his next move, Swaim held a press conference on Thursday, March 27th. He told the press that the Fort Worth police wouldn't allow him to look at the missing trio's files, and that he was fine with pursuing a lawsuit against the department to gain access if need be. If there's one thing Swaim was not afraid to do, it was take on the system in court. What John Swaim wanted in the file the most, he told the press, was a taped call made to police dispatch on the evening of Monday, December 23, 1974, the day Renee, Julie, and Rachel disappeared. On this recording, Swaim said he was told, was the description and license plate number of a vehicle called in to police by a witness. The recording was reported to Swaim to have been destroyed, however, and Police Chief T.S. Walls all but confirmed that when he told a reporter that every 60 days, the tapes are erased for reuse. Chief Walls also said he wasn't aware of any such call, and told the reporter he's not obligated to give Swaim the girl's file. Swaim shouldn't go around bothering witnesses the police have already spoken with, Chief Walls added. A couple hours after the press conference, though, Chief Walls asked to Swaim down to the Fort Worth police station. Walls allowed the private eye access to the file in the company of Deputy Police Chief J.H. Usry. The move by Swaim to pressure police with a press conference worked, and he was pleased, he said, with the cooperation the department showed him that afternoon. Not long after, in the first week of April, John Swaim's classified ad strategy panned out as well, however darkly, when he received a tip that Julie, Renee, and Rachel had been killed, their bodies buried under a bridge near the South Texas town of Port Lavaca. Although the Fort Worth police said they'd received information that the bodies of Renee Wilson, Julianne Mosley, and Rachel Trelisa were buried beneath a bridge in the coastal town Port Lavaca, Texas, back in February, and that they'd directed the department down there to search such areas, John Swaim wanted to check it out himself. The Port Lavaca police did look, Fort Worth police said, and found no trace of them. John Swaim seemed unimpressed by the efforts, if they even really searched at all, and insisted that the water levels are significantly lower in April than they were in February. And anyway, he'd enlisted the help of hundreds of volunteer searchers, Swaim said, including members of a CB radio club. He'd organized the sheriff's department in Calhoun County to lead search efforts there, and others would search bridges in Victoria County. On April 9, 1975, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram quotes John Swaim as saying something interesting, especially considering how this plays out. "I'd say that we've got one of two things," said Swaim. "Either the girls have met with foul play and are down there, or somebody else has been killed and someone up here wants them found." The private detective still wouldn't name the source, but he seemed certain that the information was good. On Sunday, April 14, 1975, a fruitless search of more than 10 bridges spanning a stretch of Texas State Highway 35 was performed by more than 100 folks, consisting of both local law enforcement and volunteer civilians. One bridge hovering over Hog Bayou was the Concentration, as John Swaim had received an anonymous call that this spot is where the bodies of Julie, Renee, and Rachel would be found. Throughout the ordeal, bits and pieces of clothing were found and shown to attending family members, but they recognized none of them. Later in the day, the search was called off. It lasted 6 hours, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Nothing of any value was found that day. A frustrated John Swaim told a reporter that he's changed his mind and believes the girls simply ran away, but he didn't really believe that. Swaim was a hothead, and in frustration often spouted off things he didn't mean. There was a lot at stake, lives at stake, and emotions were running high. By the Fort Worth Star-Telegram's evening edition, Swaim was quoted as saying he still believed that the girls' bodies were buried somewhere in that area. But the swampland, thick with vegetation and the water blackened by dense mud, was anything but accommodating to the search. The following week, the remains of two young women were found near the shoreline of Churchill Estate Lake in Bexar County, just southwest of San Antonio. Although police found many other sun-bleached bones scattered around the area the bodies were found, and told the press they were dealing with up to 5 bodies, the Bexar County medical examiner insisted that the remains were of 2 teenaged girls, and the several other bones found belonged to cows. The medical examiner said only one skull was found, which needed substantial dental work, and the parents of the Fort Worth missing trio said their girls didn't need extensive work. Descriptions of clothing and shoes found after the search of the densely brushy area also didn't appear to belong to the Fort Worth trio. But Judy Wilson had to be sure. She sent the Bexar County medical examiner Renee's dental records. Parents of the other girls followed suit. None of the records matched the remains found there. Though one of these bodies was only skeletal remains without a skull and is still unidentified, the other body, which was only partially decomposed, was identified days later by her mother as 21-year-old Carol Grainer. Perhaps feeling a little shown up in the media by Private Eye John Swaim's investigative efforts, and Swaim was a showman, the Fort Worth police took in a 21-year-old man on Monday, April 29, 1975, for questioning and a polygraph exam in connection with Julie, Rachel, and Renee's disappearances. The man, police said, was taken into custody after stalking a woman to her home, and because he lived near the Trelisa home, they thought it a good idea to put a little pressure on him. He passed the lie detector test and was released. Months passed with little word of Julie Mosley, Renee Wilson, and Rachel Trelisa in the newspapers. In those quiet months, John Swaim was still at work on the girl's case, and family, at least Renee Wilson's father Richard, was pleased with the Private Eye's efforts.
John Swaim, I liked him. Somebody saw somebody throw somebody in a river or something down at Port Lavaca, I believe it is. And John went down there, and then we went down there later on, a couple of days after John went down there. I heard he kicked the door in them apartments behind us where we lived over there on Fraser. I heard he went up there and kicked the door in. He didn't tell us all of this stuff, unless it was something that meant something, he didn't tell us. I know one time he saw a bunch of buskers gathering out somewhere just before 8:20 comes in, the 30 out there in a field, and he went out there and checked that out. He was kind of pushy.
At some point during this less active period in the press, Swaim reportedly received a call. The caller, a man, told Swaim he could lead them to the girls, but would not say if they were dead or alive. There were stipulations, too, the caller said. The anonymous man had Swaim going from payphone to payphone around the city, 17 of them, the PI said, before finally laying out his demands. First, he wanted the reward money, and next, he wanted full immunity from prosecution of a criminal act he might have been involved in concerning the trio. The final stipulation, no Fort Worth police or Texas Ranger involvement. The caller said he would only turn himself over to the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office. John Swaim told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that he spoke with District Attorney Tim Curry, who agreed with the demands, as long as the caller had nothing to do with the death of the girls, no participation, and no involvement in a conspiracy to kill them. After securing the caller's stipulations, however, Swaim never heard from him again. The case again stalled. On Friday, July 18th, Rachel Trelisa's father succumbed to cancer and was buried in Marshall, Texas. The following month, the case took another bizarre turn. At some point around that time, it's unclear when, John Swaim became aware of an individual who'd been making repeated obscene calls to an 18-year-old young woman and her 15-year-old sister for the past 2 years. Swaim set up an ambush of the man with the participation of Fort Worth police detectives, but not only because of the calls. The name of this man, who'd been arrested in 1970 and charged with indecent exposure, belonged to a 28-year-old man who'd come up several times in Swaim's investigation. Not only did this man work at a store in South Fort Worth, close to where all three of the missing girls lived, but also, Swaim said, Rachel Trelisa had applied for a job at that store shortly before she, Julie, and Renee vanished. This guy, too, would collect the phone numbers of teenage girl applicants and harass them by phone. Anyway, when the parents of the young woman and her sister who'd been receiving the lewd calls contacted John Swaim, his interest was immediately piqued. He asked the 15-year-old sister to set up a meeting with the 28-year-old man at a shopping center close to Texas Christian University on Tuesday, August 12, 1975, at 1 p.m. The man, or pedophile if you'd like, agreed to meet her. 1 p.m. rolled around, and the guy never showed. But upon returning home, he called the teenager, apologized for his tardiness, and asked if she could meet at 2:30 p.m. Swaim and the girl barely got back to the TCU area shopping center in time, and the cops were running late. The 28-year-old man showed up this time, and John Swaim took it upon himself to detain him until detectives arrived. The cops finally got there, and the man was taken into custody. There was another connection to Rachel Trelisa, too. The man had lived in the same neighborhood as the Arnolds, Rachel's parents, when she lived with them. It's unclear what became of this lead, but it presumably wasn't much. Everything, once again, slowed to a crawl. By the time the girls had been missing a full year, on December 23, 1975, John Swaim's frustration showed. He told a reporter that day that he had absolutely no leads. Earlier that month, the family's hearts were warmed by a benefit dance held at Haltom Plaza, the proceeds to go to the reward fund for information leading to Rachel Trelisa, Renee Wilson, and Julie Mosley. But still, their hearts were broken. They were hopeful that the girls were still alive, but the uncertainty and the girls' absence was chipping away at that hope, little by little. The Christmas holiday came without the joyful memories that the season should bring. The Wilsons, the Mosleys, and the Arnolds trudged on, as did Tommy Trelisa, who had since moved to Throckmorton, about 125 miles northwest of Fort Worth. The year turned, and 1976 would bring with it a reinvigorated John Swaim when new leads came about. About 95 miles southwest of Fort Worth in Eastland County, Texas, on Saturday, March 6, 1976, John Swaim, around 40 law enforcement officers, and volunteers from a CB radio club conducted an almost six-hour search for three bodies. The bodies, of course, of Julie Mosley, Renee Wilson, and Rachel Trelisa. The area being concentrated on was just off Texas State Highway 36, about 3 miles east of a little town called Rising Star. They were acting on a tip received by Swaim from a man in Honolulu, Hawaii, who said the girls had been dumped out there near an oil well. They weren't buried, the man relayed to Swaim. Rather, the killer had just discarded the bodies under some brush. Since the tipster went into a lot of detail about both the Eastland County area and the Fort Worth area, Swaim felt the matter should be looked into. Nothing, however, nothing at all, was found. This information, apparently, came to the Honolulu man in a vision. He was a dowser, a person who uses a wishbone-shaped stick and divination to locate things buried, like groundwater, gemstones, and grave sites. By the end of the fruitless efforts, searchers were cursing the man, calling him a psycho, a nut who should be investigated himself. It was just another dead end, and the last movement the case would see for a few months. The following month, in late April 1976, Tommy Trelisa filed for divorce from Rachel. It was time, Tommy told us, to move forward. His second wife's disappearance had been consuming his life. In the morning edition of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Rachel's mother, Fran Arnold, shared her disagreement with Tommy's decision to file, saying she hopes it doesn't happen. There's no proof of desertion, she said. By the time the same day's evening edition of the newspaper came out, Fran Arnold, though, had changed her tune. I'm hurt a little bit, Fran said of Tommy's filing for divorce, but once you sit back and think about it, he has a life of his own. We can't expect him to sit back and do nothing. Then came the Brazoria bones. The same month Tommy filed for divorce, on Sunday, the 18th of April, 1976, at about 2:30 p.m., an oilfield roughneck was working on a drilling rig off County Road 169, around 5 miles southeast of the town of Alvin, Texas, in Brazoria County. The man walked about 50 feet from the rig to take a load off, and as he lowered his head and wiped the sweat from his brow, he noticed a human skull. The roughneck yelled for his boss, and the two looked around a little more. Before long, they'd found another skull. Authorities were alerted and also found a small bra. Later searches uncovered clothing, knee-length blue socks, and a gold V-neck blouse. The remains were taken to Houston, where the Harris County Medical Examiner inspected them. At first, the medical examiner reported that the bones belonged to two girls, teenaged or younger, but by June 20th, he was reporting the remains were those of two females, aged 10 to 13, around 5'4" in height, and a young male, about 15 to 17 years old, standing about 5'5" tall. Word didn't travel as fast back then as it does today, of course, and authorities in Brazoria County and the town of Alvin noted that they didn't have any missing persons, but they were checking outside agencies to see if they had any. By the end of the month, the discovery caught the attention of Fort Worth law enforcement. Though one of the sets of remains was said to be a male, it was not unheard of for medical examiners to mistake female bones for male, especially if the pelvic bone was even slightly abnormal. There was talk, anyway, that all the bones belonged to females, and even the Harris County Medical Examiner wanted additional bones and an outside opinion before he made a definite conclusion. The only bones that had been found were two skulls, one mandible, and some rib bones. It seems absolutely insane that they were thinking it was three bodies, two female and one male specifically, from this small amount of remains, but they were. Regardless, another search was scheduled for July 16, 1976, to try and find more. When the Harris County Medical Examiner reported the findings, both John Swaim and the Fort Worth police thought it seemed like a good lead. Unfortunate, of course, but seemingly good, nonetheless. Besides, it loosely fit the tip that Swaim had gotten the previous year, just near Alvin and not Port Lavaca, and not under a bridge. Plus, it was practically in Houston, where the mysterious letter had the girls getting away to. On July 6, 1976, Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator Jim Minter and private investigator John Swaim traveled south to inspect the bones. Minter was now assisting Fort Worth Police Detective George Hudson on the missing trio's case, a move that finally had at least Renee Wilson's father, Richard, satisfied with the efforts that the department was putting forth.
George Hudson. Yeah, put George Hudson on it. And that man worked day and night. If anybody said anything to him, he stayed till he found out. One time there was a woman that told us that she knew something as of what she was trying to do was scam us. And so we called Hudson. He went out and picked her up, carried her downtown. And she admitted that she was just trying to get money off of us. But George Hudson really, really worked on it.
Minter and Swaim began comparing the teeth with dental records and looking at the bones through X-ray. But, of course, they couldn't provide any more of an identification than the medical examiner of the most populous city in the state. The families were on edge waiting for the results of the Brazoria bones comparisons. The remains, however, did not belong to Rachel Trelisa, Renee Wilson, and Julie Mosley. Due to terrible organization and investigation by Brazoria County law enforcement, they wouldn't know that for a fact until almost 5 years later. In 1981, when a new sheriff took over, he reopened the case of the Brazoria bones. While he did such at the request of the Fort Worth Police Department, he, too, wanted those remains identified yesterday. On Monday, March 2, 1981, The new sheriff in town sent deputies out to the remote oil field where the bones had been found in April of 1976, and the surrounding swampland. It was virtually a jungle. Thick, overgrown vegetation and bushes bearing hardened 1-inch thorns covering nearly every square inch. Muddy water, marshy ground, and exposed tree roots at every step. The crew was headed up by Brazoria County Sheriff's Lieutenant Matt Wingo, who was forward-thinking and thorough, like the sheriff. He didn't mind the department looking bad for its past, as long as he was doing what he could to correct those mistakes. These searches, unlike the ones 5 years before, were extensive. Brazoria County deputies, Fort Worth police, and jail trustees all searched for days on end. They found a lot. A high school literature class copy of the book Of Mice and Men, and two badly deteriorated pairs of girls' pants. The right side of a jawbone, 19 human teeth, 4 spinal bones, and a partial tailbone. All things missed by poor and mismanaged searches by the former Brazoria County Sheriff and his men. But they weren't done. Subsequent searches uncovered a lower leg bone, 3 more teeth, another rib, and the other half of the jawbone found before. In all, the searches lasted 25 days. That's how you do it. By the end of March 1981, it looked like the Wilsons, the Mosleys, and the Arnolds would finally have answers. But it wasn't to be. The bones, for one, did not belong to 3 people at all. Rather, they belonged to 2. The remains were those of 12-year-old Brooks Bracewell and 14-year-old Georgia Gear, who vanished while skipping school on September 6, 1974. Their murders remain officially unsolved today in 2020. Mistakes by authorities in 1976, obviously, and a later mistake of which I cannot find the origin, only added to the confusion of the Brazoria bones, as they relate, or rather don't relate, to the disappearances of Rachel, Julie, and Renee. The bad searches by police in the beginning, the bad medical examiner guessing 3 bodies off of just a handful of bones, mistakes in the press continuing to speak of 3 bodies when there were only 2, even after they were already identified, and a simple mistake that has spread and caused even more confusion in recent years. Some sources talk about bones found in Alvord, Texas, a little town about 50 miles north of Fort Worth. Alvord, Texas is not in Brazoria County and is nowhere near Brazoria County, and there were never any bones found in Alvord that were associated with the missing trio. None. Only Alvin. Don't believe everything you read on Wikipedia, folks. John Swaim wasn't alive to see the Brazoria bones identified as Georgia Gear and Brooks Bracewell. Perhaps when he passed, he still believed the remains belonged to the Fort Worth missing trio, but I don't know. On the morning of October 19, 1979, Fort Worth police responded to a disturbance at John Swaim's apartment. He was obviously drunk and told the officers, reportedly, that he'd been chasing his whiskey with Quaaludes. According to police, they confiscated the ludes. But later that night, after Swaim's sister and her husband couldn't get an answer to their knocks on his door, police returned, broke in, and found the man, who was only 35 years old, dead. Beside his body was an empty bottle of whiskey and another bottle of pills. In the Fort Worth Star-Telegram article about John Winter Swaim's death, the nicest thing said about him was the story's title, Private Eye Sought Facts, Not Friends. Gary Davis, who worked with Swaim at his agency, Special Services, and was considered, perhaps, his only real friend, said, "It was his business to get information on everyone. He hurt a lot of people because he did a dirty job. And if he went up against you, you were bound to lose." Another private investigator called him slimy and sneaky, but seemed to almost be praising him for it. They were traits that made him better at his job, perhaps. A local lawyer said you'd have to be crazy to trust John Swaim in the article. The head of detectives for the Fort Worth police said he had no respect for the recently deceased man. John Swaim was said to have dirt on everyone, from cops and other officials, to lawyers, to local oil tycoon Cullen Davis. Though several folks who knew Swaim spoke of his recent downward spiral, taking pills and drinking even heavier than he already did after his wife divorced him, no one saw suicide coming, assuming in the article that that's what he did. But it was eventually ruled that the death was an accidental overdose by the Tarrant County Medical Examiner. Many who are still around to remember believe he was taken out for having just the right dirt on just the right person, or perhaps getting too close to someone on one of his cases. As far as the missing trio goes, whatever the case, and whatever his motive in doing so, whether it was fame, obsession, that he actually cared, or perhaps a combination of all those things, Swaim is said to have spent over $20,000 of his own money investigating the disappearances of Renee Wilson, Rachel Trelisa, and Julie Mosley.
I think if he hadn't have died, he would have found out something.
At the request of John Winter Swaim, all of his files, whether they were cases he worked or dirt he kept, were destroyed upon his death, including his file on the Fort Worth missing trio. Decades later, another private investigator was hired by Rachel's brother, Rusty Arnold. While there wasn't as much attention in the media as a result, mostly since the press had all but completely forgotten about an old case that looked like it would never get solved, he did come up with some interesting points. Starting next episode, we'll start looking at persons of interest over the years, some well known and some not so much. If you have any information about the disappearances of Mary Rachel Trelisa, Lisa Renee Wilson, and Julianne Mosley, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Okay, once again, thanks to Kelly Arnold, Sherry McReynolds, Kim Cadell, Judy Burns, Jana Roberts, Jackie Jones, Linda Trelisa, Rusty Arnold, Wanda McCaslin, Mary Kay, Kim, Diane, and so many others. Special thanks to Richard Wilson for his contribution to this episode. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company to their database. We'll provide a link in the show notes. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Butcher Painter and the Odessa Lust murders, among others. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. It means the world to us, and we couldn't do this without you. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Dallas Morning News, the Brazosport Facts, the Alvin Sun, and the Tyler Morning Telegraph were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.